Hello and welcome to the W Word, that is W for wellness. I am your host, Anna Whitehouse, and I'm joined every episode by our resident expert who knows all the things, Kimberly.
Hi there, I'm Kimberly Wilson. I'm a chartered psychologist and I'm here to bust any wellness myths.
We have felt with this podcast, we want to make sure that wellness is slightly reclaimed. It's become a bit of a buzzword. So we have got celebrity guests on to help us decode some of the weird trends, the fads out there, but also to sort of deep dive into what inner strength is and just how you can be the best version of yourself. Now, this podcast would not be possible without Arla Lacto Free, which is all about giving you the inner strength to do what feels good, whether that is just getting to the gym, just getting help, getting back to yourself, or getting out of here, which is something we're all feeling in the context of a pandemic. So I'm not going to waste any more time introducing this week's topic, which is extreme meditation, Vipassana, something I kind of need to get into right now. So we're going to shine a light on that in a second. But for now, I want to welcome today's guest, who is someone I have been lightly and not so lightly stalking on Instagram for a very long time. She is the author of the book, Am I Ugly? A prolific public speaker, a 5-board accredited life coach, and the woman behind the Instagram page and campaign Scarred Not Scared. Please welcome Michelle Ellman. Hello,
Thank
Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you ready to talk wellness?
Yes. I feel like that's a word that I now relate to diet. Like, it's a pseudonym that people use to talk about diet culture, because now diet's such a demonized word that they're like, oh, wellness instead.
Yeah, let's talk about the W word.
Yeah.
So Michelle, I'm going to put quite a big topic on the table to start. 2020, how's it been for you? How was lockdown?
Well, I think the beginning part of it, I was like life coach mode. I've got all the tools and resources to handle this. I've been through a pandemic before. So I guess pandemic's a new word for everyone else.
Sorry, but this is your second pandemic.
But I was like, this is old news, guys, because there was a pandemic in Hong Kong when I was 10 years old. So what, 17 years ago, and I missed most of year five. And we were out of school for maybe 4 to 6 months. And then we went into the summer term and we went back in September as if nothing had happened. But we missed most of year five and we got faxed our homework every day. So I was kind of used to it. Like, I knew the drill.
Old news now.
I was very much being like the life coach on Instagram, being like, guys, this is fine. We'll be fine. It's going to be a few months. Enjoy it while it lasts. Like, we'll be fine. We'll be out of this. And then I got coronavirus, like right before we locked down. And so I was like, that's fine. I've had 15 surgeries. I'm ill all the time. I can handle this. My hardest part of lockdown was right after I realized this is not passing in the same speed it did last time.
But can we just come back to you getting coronavirus? You kind of carried on there.
Well,
I was like, how was
it
that?
It came out of nowhere. So that week I had already slowed down because, as I mentioned, I've had 15 surgeries. I was already like trying to be more careful than everyone else was. I'd only seen 3 people that week, so I think I must have got it from the tube. Had a friend over, was celebrating like the night before, had champagne and everything. She left the next morning, and then the morning after that, woke up at 3 a.m, unable to breathe. Called my sister, because you know when you're like, you don't want to call your parents because it's going to freak them out. So the second tier is my sister. And my sister was like, just call 111. And I was like, no, they're going to be dealing with everyone with coronavirus. And she was like, you do have a symptom of coronavirus. So I was like, in my head, I just called and expected them to say, don't worry about it, stay at home. And if it gets worse, call us back. They asked me all these questions. Have you ever had a heart problem? All my answers were no. And then they went, great, we're going to send an ambulance to you. You're going to need to pack a bag in case you have to stay overnight. And I just went into like meltdown. I was like, I've never been in an ambulance. I don't want to do this right now. But because it was so early on, even the paramedics didn't really know what to do. So we just ended up being very casual about it. And they were all in their hazmat suits and
There's nothing casual about that. Like, there is absolutely...
when they arrived, it was very casual. When they left, it was less. And then we went into the ambulance and they essentially said they didn't have any tests in the hospital. So to go home and make sure you isolate, and if you find it harder to breathe or anything's impacting your daily life, then come back into the hospital.
So you had before this been sort of talking to your audience very much about wellness techniques, how to get through this, because you're a life coach.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is your job. And then you hit like a very significant brick wall. Now, how did you personally, not for your audience, but how did you get through that?
The worst thing is I'd started making this joke online that I was going to be your party entertainer for this period. And like, it was just a joke that I made one day and then it caught on. But I didn't want to tell my
audience. What would your party trick be? What would you do?
It was just like, I was going to teach you all these tools. Like, it wasn't anything a party entertainer would actually be. But it was like your life coach party entertainer. I don't know. I turned it into a party. But I didn't want to tell my audience I had coronavirus because I thought there was enough fear going around in the world. And I was like, until I come out of it, I just don't see the purpose. And so I pretended like I didn't have it online for 2 weeks. And then once I was out of it, was like, by the way, the reason why I was talking about having good boundaries around corona conversations is because you don't know who you're talking to who actually has it and your anxiety around it and all the general health anxiety going on. I understand that like everyone's experiencing that, but you could be talking to someone who has it and they're like literally living it right now. So if someone says, can we stop this conversation? It's really important that you actually do stop the conversation.
And I think, you know, from the sounds of it, you really had to dig deep in that period of time. Like you had to find quite a significant amount of inner strength. How do you see inner strength in terms of going through something that we've all gone through? We've all gone through a pandemic. You've gone through two, you know. I know, don't want anyone showing off here, but...
Well, I feel like everyone's wired slightly differently. And because my childhood was full of surgeries, my inner strength, I guess, always comes out most when I'm being challenged. I've always been best that way. It's why I enjoy like live TV and all of those things, because when I'm put under pressure, I actually think I perform my best. So getting coronavirus, being put in lockdown, all of that was me at my best. But I'm seeing this pandemic as a global trauma that we're all experiencing. But with a trauma, we all experience the emotions that come through it at different paces, in different ways. And also when your body feels that you are safe. We are all going to perceive safeness at a different stage. Some of us will see it the moment the government says lockdown's over. Some of us will only see it once there's a vaccine.
Or once the pubs have opened. That was a
lot of people defined.
People sort of celebrated it a bit too soon there, I think.
It sounds like you identify yourself as an endurer. Like, I can endure, I can handle it. But does that...
That's quite like, negative.
Thing is, does it get in the way of recognizing when you do need to stop?
Yes, and I definitely experienced that towards the end of 2019. And essentially, because of the surgeries I had when I was younger, I always thought I had very little time on this earth. So I was always like running, and making the most of the time I had, which sounds so positive. It comes with the downside that you never stop.
So how did you start moving forward? Because it's something Kimberly and I have been talking a lot on this podcast, is it's, you know, not about these big, extreme wellness trends that you go, right, okay, we'll come onto the topic, the Vipassana, in a bit, but I'm just going to go to a silent retreat for 2 weeks and then I'm done. Lots of little things when you, because weirdly, I follow you closely, ever so closely. You know, the two eyes emoji. That's basically me in the shadows. But you know, it's the small things that you can do every day instead of these extreme kind of fads that I think people go along. What were the little things that you started to do to reclaim, I suppose, who you were a little bit after getting coronavirus?
I think for me, it's always been about listening to your body. Your body tells you so much. Your body holds all the answers. And like, if you listen to your instinct and you listen to your intuition, you know the right thing for you. It's our shame that overrides that. It's when you're like, oh no, I should be working. All those shoulds that we put into our life, that's what stops us from listening to our body. And if I look back at that time, there were so many warning signs I could have listened to slow down. The main thing I actually did became really aware of how I was using social media. So I realized that every time I pick up my phone, I felt like I was like preparing for an attack when I went on social media.
Have you ever downloaded the Moment app, which tells you how long you're on social media? That's quite a smack in the face.
So in the iPhone, they have the screen time. And that was a massive shock to me because my screen time was some days 13 hours, most days 10 hours. It was bad. And like the excuse becomes, oh, but it's my job. There are people who have my job who don't have that screen time. And I think what had essentially happened was I'd gone through a spell of getting a lot of criticism, and I don't think I ever fully recovered from that in terms of I didn't digest it, I didn't process it, I didn't heal it in a way that my brain realised I wasn't being attacked anymore.
It sounds really noisy.
Yeah.
Like, I think it sounds like I'm just getting a sense of lots of voices, lots of opinions.
Yeah.
And I think you might need to go to a silent retreat.
Well, so I kind of created my own silent retreat over...
Do you do Vipassana? Have you done Vipassana?
No, but I've been very big on meditation in general and mindfulness in general. So I've been very aware of what I call somatic processing, where you sit and you feel all the feelings in your body. And so when I turn my phone off, the first thing I do is I kind of do a body scan, and I'm like, what am I feeling? And I can feel like anxiety in my chest, and like you sit with that feeling. And when you put a focus on a strong sensation in your body, it tends to get more intense. And then you realize that's the pain you're avoiding. And like every time I pick up my phone, that's literally what I'm avoiding.
I think very few people will sit with themselves and say, I need to sit through this. Now I Google and Kimberly knows the science. So that's where we sit. And I want to be very clear on our roles because I ain't no expert. But I have done the Google. And so Vipassana is kind of, it seems like it's less of a sort of fad trend. It's more of an ancient technique, which is practiced by Buddhists. And always correct me if I'm wrong, Kimberly. And it's used across the world. Like my best friend went to a silent retreat in Hertfordshire. She didn't speak to a soul in that week, and she had deep-rooted anxiety. So it's used for a lot of things, and you can often retreat or go completely in isolation. Vipassana is really about sort of self-exploratory journey, as far as I'm aware. Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Kimberly. Was my Googling good?
Yeah, I think you've hit upon it, really. And the thing about meditation, I mean, it's an ancient practice.
Yeah.
And it has been slightly commodified in the world of wellness. And it's worth saying that it's not for everybody. And I think particularly if you're not someone who's very good at sitting with emotions, actually we think about 1 in 12 people, just diving straight into meditation can actually trigger anxiety for them or trigger a depressive episode. And that might be because they're defended against all of these feelings for a long time. And actually what they need is someone else to help support them to manage these emotions.
Have you tried it?
So I meditate on and off, but I really think that I have other things in my life that act as meditation for me. Because for me, meditation is about focused attention. And I do lots of things that are about focused attention. And I think a lot of my work is about focused attention. And I feel like I'm quite good at that kind of, also years of analysis will do that for you as well. So I feel like I have quite a good relationship with myself. Like maybe I should try and practice meditation a bit more, but I feel like I'm in a good enough balance at the moment.
I was really big on, and I still am, inner child meditation. So you going back to your 7-year-old and talking to her, and you're sitting on a bench with her, and the person on the audiobook will literally tell you what to say to your inner child. So it takes off all of the pressure of not knowing what to do, but also it doesn't really give you much time to go into started thinking about your day because you're actually actively doing something with your brain.
So I have tried guided meditation once, and I remember we did it. They were saying, you know, imagine the mountain, you're the base of the mountain. And they were like, imagine what the mountain looks like, what's on the mountain, who's there. And we had to then go through the group to explain what we'd seen. And I went into great detail about this goat that was on my mountain, and it was pink, and it was all just really psychedelic. And then it got to the next person, they're like, it's a mountain, it's got rocks and grass and stuff. And I was like the only one with a pink boat, with a pink goat.
Well, that's good imagination.
Well, there you go. That's what I thought. Thank you. This is why you're a life coach. So I suppose that was my question. Your professional and personal lines are, I imagine, I mean, I'm not saying you blend them within your work, but with social media, the line gets blurred because the personal becomes the professional.
Well, I think also I've blurred my job slightly in terms of the fact that most life coaches work with individual clients. And in the last 2 years, I've stopped doing that. And I see a lot of my social media content as life coaching, but essentially group coaching, because I'm putting out like non-personalized content every day and giving things that are closer to advice than life coaching.
You also give a lot of yourself, or have, on your social media about, yes, your own story, your own experience. Has your thinking changed around that, or are you
happy that you did that? Do you think it was important?
I think it served a purpose at a time in my life. I don't think it serves a purpose anymore. And I wouldn't ever be ashamed or embarrassed about what I once put out. But I think essentially this career started that by me putting a single bikini picture up and it going viral. There is no way I could have expected or controlled that. But also because that bikini picture was me with my scars, like Scar Not Scared was this, just this hashtag I put at the bottom of the post. I didn't realize that would lead to people's entitlement to knowing not only my medical history, but every single part of the worst experience of my life and essentially my trauma. But because I wasn't far along on, I think it had been 2 years of me processing that myself, I still wasn't comfortable labeling it as trauma, and I still wasn't okay recognizing that, like, I am genuinely putting my trauma there out there every day. And I think part of the burnout was the fact that at the beginning of 2019, I was like, I'm not building a career on trauma anymore. This is not healthy. It's not okay. I need to move on, because my last surgery was when I was 19 years old. I'm 27 now. So as much as it's all new information to my following and it's new information to every single new follower I get from this day forward, it's not new for me. And I'm a 5-board accredited life coach. I would like someone to talk about my brain, not like my body every day. And so it was definitely about learning boundaries and realizing that just because I've shared this information in the past doesn't mean I have to share it again.
Can we sort of take it back to the feelings around that first post? You know, I'm not looking to go back over the trauma, but just I think that inner strength it must have found, because that was clearly a pivotal moment in your life. How did you feel? Can you just describe posting that image, which is very contrasting to that polished veneer of social media? How did you find the strength to do that? And I think, what was the emotion around it?
I must say the hardest part wasn't posting it on social media. The hardest part was actually doing it. Wearing a bikini for the first time was, I guess, my final acceptance of my body. Up until that point, I had been confident in my body, and it was just a flippant comment that one of my friends made saying, oh, you're a body confidence coach, but you don't wear bikinis. And I was like, oh, I guess that's I love brutally honest friends. It's just like my style of person. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. Thanks for that wake up call. And it's funny because when she said it, the sentence that came out of my mouth turned into the title of that post, which is people with scars can't wear bikinis. And you know, when words come out of your mouth and you're like, no, that's my old mindset. I don't believe that anymore. I was like, okay, this summer I'm going to wear a bikini for the first time. And I was terrified. I tried to get out of it so many times because I was going to Florida and I was like, I never even thought to buy a bikini. And we were on this coaching retreat, and just coincidence, one woman got up, and after the first day got up saying anything they'd learned in the morning, someone got up and said, I just wore a bikini for the first time. And I was sitting there like covered in shame, being like, that was meant to be my goal and I've not done it. And so I turned to my brand new friend who I made like 3 hours before, and I go, that was what I was meant to do this trip. Like, I had set a goal for this, and then I just didn't buy one, let alone pack one. And she was like, there's a hotel store, we could go downstairs and get one now. And I was like, no, it's fine, they won't have my size. And they had one bikini in my size, and she was like, great, you don't have any excuse now, so you're gonna go out and wear one. And that was probably the most scary part. And the funny thing was that the thing I was scared of was when I was 10 years old, I wore a bikini for the first time, and it got met with looks of shock, pity, and horror. And like, out of all of those things, it was the pity I couldn't stand the most. Like, when someone looks at you with pity, it's essentially saying, like, I would not want to be you. And as much as I was 10 years old, didn't have the word for it, I knew it felt bad, and I knew I didn't want to feel that way. And when I came out in that bikini at 21, I realized I'm not 10 years old anymore. Can you imagine a 10-year-old with the scars I have now? You would look at a child like that with pity, but I'm not a child anymore. And it was as soon as I walked out and no one reacted to it in that way, it was this like instant mindset shift of, I'm not 10 anymore. Of course, they weren't staring at my scars because of what they looked like. They were staring at those scars with pity because I was 10 and had gone through, at that point, 7 surgeries. But by the age of 11, I'd gone through 15, so.
Did you feel stronger going to the shop, putting on the bikini, having the photo, posting it? The response was phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, I think people forget that sometimes even the overwhelming good response is as draining emotionally as negative responses.
Yeah.
But did you feel stronger after doing that, would you say?
I think the main thing I felt was pride. Like, I work a lot, as I said, with inner child. And I genuinely, like, my 10-year-old was proud of me. Like, it sounds so silly, but, like, she was like, you did it and you don't care what anyone thinks. And before I posted it, I did stop for a second and went, what's the worst thing that could happen? And I was like, they're going to call me fat and they're going to call me ugly. And I was like, great, I don't really care about those words, moving on. Like, and I was ready for those words. And those were the only words that came. And every time I saw that, the main thing I thought is, if you're calling me fat, then, like, you're not focusing on the scars. Like, the whole point of this is the scars. And I just realized that there are so many people who have scars. The fact that the only time I saw someone with a scar outside of a hospital setting, I was 21, is the saddest part of it. That if I had seen someone younger proudly embracing their scars, I don't think I would have been as insecure.
But that is what you've done for people. And I think that's the bit that I kind of want to try and unlock here is how can people, somebody who maybe hasn't found their inner strength, you know, maybe is looking at you going, I could never do that. I'm really glad she could do that, but I can never do that. Are there any sort of wellness techniques that you have found along the way to build that inner strength, to stand up, put the bikini on and say, hi, I'm here?
I personally believe that if you're still trying to change your body, you are never going to accept it. And I think the pivotal moment actually came when I was 15. I mean, the scars I had when I was 15 years old aren't common, put it that way. And so there was a moment when I was 15 where the girl I envied and thought if I had her body, all my problems would be fixed, was talking about how ugly she was and how fat her thighs were. And I just noticed that the moment she said it, my eyes went to her thighs. And I was like, isn't it funny that the one thing you don't want to draw any attention to, when you're moaning about your body, you draw attention to it. And like, I've never looked at her thighs in my life. And even the fact that I just thought she was the most beautiful person in the world, I never analyzed her thighs. But when she said it, I looked at her thighs. And there was just like this click in my brain where I was like, I'm drawing more attention to the thing I want no one to ever notice. And I just got to a point where I was like, I can't change my scars. And up until between the ages of 10 and 15, I wanted plastic surgery. And there was a greater fear. The fear of going into hospital, the fear of having surgery again was greater than my fear of living with scars. I had no choice. So I got to a point where I was like, to be honest, I accepted I was ugly. And that's a really sad thing to say. And trust me, I don't believe it now, even though my book's called Am I Ugly? But like when I was 15, I was just like, I'm ugly, but there are ugly people who find love. There are ugly people who live fulfilled lives, their entire lives. I'm just going to be an ugly person who has a great life. And that's essentially what I accepted. And I don't know whether that's relatable at all, but it was more realistic than love your body, look in the mirror and think you're beautiful every day. Because that was like not on my list. And any person who was preaching that or talking about that, I would just go, well, you don't have my scars. You don't have my body.
You don't know.
And you don't know what it feels like to have your worst memories marked on your body so that every time I look in the mirror, I'm not only reminded of how ugly I am, but I'm reminded of my trauma. I was never told you're allowed to be angry. And it was even like the day after I got told I had a brain tumor at 11 years old, a psychologist was sent into my room and diagnosed me with temper tantrums and gave me an antidepressant. And I was like, would you tell an adult that they have a brain tumor? I think a normal reaction is to be angry, frankly. But it's why it's led to how I life coach now, because I'm like pathologizing someone when they just need to feel their emotions.
But how do you help your clients? I know you don't have clients, but how do you help your followers to get to where you are? Like what kind of routine do you have to keep yourself, I suppose, going to an extent? I think just, you know, for every person who wants to look back at their 10-year-old self right now listening to this podcast, can you give us some specific details and help in terms of your life coaching?
This is going to sound really wishy-washy and trendy, but essentially it starts with self-compassion. So if you wake up in the morning and you need an extra hours of sleep, listen to your body. Like, why are we shaming ourselves for resting? Why are we shaming ourselves for stopping? And it's every element of that. If you're hungry 2 hours after you've eaten a meal, then listen to that. Like, if you were thirsty after you've just had a drink of water, you would get another drink of water. So why are we not doing that with food? It's every aspect of that. And then also not beating yourself up for having those days and having those moments. I call them duvet days, where like I just need to sit and feel everything I'm feeling. But what the main thing I say is feel your emotions, which is so like, it's so complex, but also so simple. But it's literally about sitting still and feeling what's in your body and just recognizing it. If you can only sit with it for 2 minutes, that's better than 0 minutes.
But what about exercise, for example? Like, does that not have a huge impact on being able to do that? Like, are there lots of other sort of factors that around that?
So when it comes to fitness, I think the greatest opportunity it provides you is to associate inside your body. So if anyone's ever been insecure or your body's ever been an unsafe place, either because of your race or your disability, you almost check out from your body. And so when you go on a walk, for example, if you check in with how your legs are feeling, how your heart's feeling, how you breathing, even just focusing on your breath, that gives you an opportunity to actually start connecting with your body. Because the hardest thing when I say, feel your feelings or feel your emotions or process your emotions, is people will literally say to me, I have no clue what I feel. And it's because they're so disconnected from their body. And it's because their body's been made to feel like to be an unsafe place or to be something that they can't trust. And so it's starting to build that small connection. And with fitness, it definitely helped me on my body positive journey, because I realized that my body's so much greater than its beauty or how it looks. It's keeping me alive every single day. And that realization literally came in a hospital bed, because I used to moan about how my body doesn't work my entire life. And it just flipped how I looked at my body as not a place to be unsafe, but that my body's been fighting for me my entire life and that we're on the same team.
And I suppose, Kimberly, just from your side, from everything that Michelle has said and spoken so eloquently about, what could you advise people listening who have felt any of the things that Michelle has along the way? From your side?
Yeah, I think what Michelle really encapsulates is this idea of embodiment. And I think you're absolutely right that when people get struggle with their emotions and connecting with them and understanding them and feeling them, because we forget or just don't know that emotions are embodied. They are physical, physiological sensations that then are interpreted by your brain. But if you've been disconnected from your body for whatever reason, whether it's through trauma or whether it's just through our enculturalization, which gets us to look at our bodies as objects rather than be in them and feel them, then you disconnect from those sensations, or you don't trust them, or you don't like them, or you just don't know what to do with them.
Have you ever done that? Like, because I know you've got a lot of advice. Well, not advice, you don't give advice, but...
I feel like I've been quite fortunate in that I have always felt... I've always trusted my instincts. I always have, to the point when I was really younger, I was like, do I have a sixth sense? I always really felt very, very connected with my body. And I think that's just innate constitution. I think that's just the way I was made. But what I think happened was that it protected me from the kind of really extreme disembodiment, disengagement from a body that you get, particularly, I mean, it happens for men as well increasingly, but particularly for a young woman, how we're all just invited to look at our bodies from the outside as ornaments to be shifted and shaped and reorganized, rather than as me, as a whole integrated me, not just as a kind of meat suit that carries my brain around, right? So...
A meat suit. Isn't that something Lady Gaga wore once to
exactly. That's the way it is, right? We think of I or me as this part upwards, and then the body is just whatever feeds my brain and carries my head around. Yeah. And actually, if you're thinking about you, everything you know about the world comes through your body, through your senses, whether it's touch, taste, feel, sight. Everything that you understand about the world comes through your body. So we really need to have much, much more respect for the body as a tool of sensation and understanding, and not just as an ornament.
Before we move on to gut instinct, I would love to know about any weird or wonderful wellness trends that you've come across. Because Kimberly and I have spoken about this at length. Just social media just feels like a lot of white noise, and you're like, who actually knows the stuff out there? How have you navigated that?
Well, when it comes to wellness trends and when it comes to social media, please do not listen to anyone who is not an expert in what they're talking about. And when I say expert, I mean qualified. Like, if you think about most of the wellness trends, they're coming from people who aren't qualified, but worse than that, they're actually using their appearance to sell things. So for example, a fitness person selling a fitness guide, are they actually qualified in personal training? Probably not. What they're inherently The inherent message in the post is, if you buy this guide, you will look like me. So the actual qualification they're using is their appearance. But who says they don't have a personal trainer behind the scenes or a private chef behind the scenes who's getting them to help be their appearance? And this is the problem with Instagram largely, is that it's a visual first platform. And no matter, you can't get around it. The caption doesn't come first. So you see the picture first, that draws the eye in, and then only will you read the caption after you've been...
I found you through your viral picture. So yeah. I know you've moved on from then, but what I think is interesting is the journey you have kind of been on, where you started out, put that very bold in, you know, when you look back at the time when you put that up, you know, Instagram was this polished space of pugs and peonies. And then you're like, this is me, you know, I'm here.
But also that was intentional. So I saw this baby movement of body positivity, and body positivity has existed for years, but online, but the movement of body positivity was tiny and still like very much in contrast to the rest of the highly filtered Instagram feeds that we were used to. But it was the fact that I saw this baby online movement growing, and I was like, I still don't see someone who looked like me. And I was like, I need to change that. And I'm confident, so why not me? And so it was very much a thing of, I don't want this movement to grow with the conversation of surgery and scars being left out. And that was very much the motivation behind posting that.
Because you know what's interesting? So many people say, why me? And actually, why not me? Yeah, I think it's fascinating.
I mean, I said, why me growing up my entire life?
Why me? Why not me?
Brain surgery, why me? Obstructed bowels, why me? It was the first time I said, why not me?
Why not you? And I think, you know, we are in the middle of an online body positivity wellness revolution. It feels like things are shifting. How important is it that things do shift, Kimberly? And do you feel like how important wellness is right now in 2020?
I'm not typically pessimistic, but I think, well, certainly my personal bugbear with wellness with a capital W as a kind of industry is how elitist it is. And my question has always been, if wellness is about illness prevention and health promotion, right? It's about staying out of hospital as long as you can, essentially. If that's the case, then why is it not targeted at the people with the greatest health risks? I think there's an awful lot of work still to do.
So, Michelle, we want to talk about gut instinct, going with your gut. I'm just thinking of other puns I can put in there. Because as you know, like, gut and mind are inextricably linked. And there are a lot of people, I mean, myself included, we've had a few people on this podcast already who are lactose intolerant. So, you know, that's where they've turned to Arla lacto-free. And that's really, really helped them because it's easier to digest than regular milk. Do you ever sort of listen to your gut instinct? Are you really in tune with it, would you say?
I think I learned about my gut instincts the best way by actually the times when I didn't listen to it, and then something goes wrong and I'm like, I had that voice in my head, but I ignored it and pushed through and thought I was smarter. And then I was like, oh, I learned that lesson the hard way. And that's actually how I started discovering my inner voice and being like, oh, okay, so when my brain was yelling at me to stop, I probably should have stopped at that point. And it's just around certain people or any of those things where, like, my brain is telling me you're not safe, or like, I don't feel safe around this person. And then I will still divulge really vulnerable information as an attempt to bond, and then be like, oh no, that was a mistake. And my gut knew that.
You know, when you think, don't say that, and then out it comes. Yeah. And you're filling that silence with words that just shouldn't be there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's things like that where I'm like, oh, okay, so my gut was right. And so it just got to a point where I was like, every time I've not listened to my gut, something bad happened. So now start listening to your gut. Or even what I was mentioning before about burnout, how many warning signs my body was telling me, like, slow down, otherwise you're going to get ill. And they were like, fine, you're not going to listen to me. You're going to get ill now.
From the moment I started following you, which was from that viral post, you know, you've definitely, and I would say, I don't think it's fair to say you've built a career on loving yourself, but I've definitely followed you and seen you loving yourself. And I think what I want to know sort of behind that veneer of, and it's not a veneer of polish because you don't put that out, but behind the scenes, you know, backstage, what is the link between the mental and the physical for you?
I don't try to hide the duvet days. I don't try to hide the days where I roll out of bed at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I do it from a very self-compassionate place of, my body needs more rest. my body is not the same as anyone else's. I've had 15 surgeries. I have a chronic illness. If I need more rest, I'm going to take it. If I need movement, then I'm going to take it. And I'm just going to listen to what my body says. But also, if I need to sit and cry for a day, which I'm very honest about that, I'm a big crier. It's a great way I get my emotions out, and I let it out. And I talk about that because I just think there shouldn't be any shame around crying. And I also think there shouldn't be any shame around being an emotional person or being a highly empathetic person. Me just being like me and showing that I love myself is way more powerful than telling everyone how much I love myself every day.
Wow. I think I kind of want to take that little soundbite and just play it to my daughter on repeat at bedtime every single night, because I think this is coming back to the 10-year-old. I think this is just what we're not told.
Yeah.
You know, it's that you don't need to, it doesn't need to be like, look, there's a woman with scars doing this or wearing a bikini. And, you know, those societal limitations, I think, weigh us down from 10 years old. So it feels like from quite early on, you went with your gut instinct. I mean, from that moment of posting, when was the last time you followed that instinct, like recently?
I think around the pandemic, I followed my instinct about everything. Like, I just have got to a point where it's always proved me right. But you say that I followed my gut my whole life. I did not until I went into therapy. So I repressed and repressed everything that I felt around my surgeries until I was 21. And then it came in the middle of a psychology lecture, just like quite classically flashing before my eyes all of, and it was just one sentence. And funnily enough, it was why me? Because that's something I used to say in hospital. And the psychologist up at the front who had come in to give a guest lecture had said, when you go into hospital as a psychologist, they're not prepared for a psychologist, that you're only there for physical illness. And so when you're met with mental illness, they're sometimes not ready. And the main thing that you'll experience is someone going like, why me? And when she said that, it just like brought me back to like 10-year-old me. And I just like was crying, but trying to hide it in this like uni lecture stuck between everyone, all my friends, trying to pretend like I wasn't crying. The lecturer caught my eye and was just like, by the way, if anyone needs to leave at this moment, feel free to leave. And I just sat there because I was like, I can't let my friends see me cry. And so that took me into PTSD and took me into therapy for the first time, which ironically was a really hard thing to do considering I'd always wanted to be a psychologist. I was a psychology student in my final year, about to graduate in 2 months.
Were you jealous of your own psychologist?
Oh, I was so jealous that I was like, I want to be the psychologist, but I do not want to be in therapy.
It's absolutely classic. There's a meme that's like, do you really need to be a psychology student, or do you just need therapy?
Yeah. But also that's what I realized when I looked around at my friend. I was like, oh, okay, so psychology degrees are an excuse to help yourself without saying you need help. Great, wonderful. That was me to a T. Where like, and also I think it's just like timely that I had the breakdown 2 months before graduating, which is perfect timing. Until that point, I was, how my friends used to describe me, and this is part of the reason I didn't go to therapy for, like, it took me 3 months of nonstop crying to finally go to therapy at that point in my life. The reason why was because one of my friends the day before to me had said, you laugh more in a day than I do laugh in a month. So my perception of myself was, I'm the happy friend in the friendship group. I'm the party animal. I'm the person who gets up on the table dancing. Like, I'm the life of the party. What happens when I'm not that person anymore? I don't want to find out.
Because you can be highly functioning. I think that's the thing, that the disconnect between somebody who's highly functioning and seemingly successful, and behind, whether it's the squares on Instagram or whether it's behind the career or the smile, you know, and this is something I think, you know, Kimberly and you together have kind of probably experienced with a lot of different people. There's a brokenness that people can miss, I think.
I genuinely think I wouldn't have had PTSD when I was 20 years old if someone, when I was younger, had just said the words, you're allowed to be angry. I was never allowed to be angry. I was never allowed to be sad. The fact that I went through 15 surgeries and I never once cried about it is strange. Not once. And so I went into hospital in second year of uni. I think that was the small, like, breaking point. And then I was like, nope, I'm going back to uni. I'm going to go back to my life. Rushed back to uni. Had a really stressful time. And I think as the moment my body felt like I was safe again, it was like, great, now deal with your PTSD. And it wasn't just the PTSD from being hospitalized at 19. It was everything that I had never felt. And then being told you had PTSD, I was like, trauma, like, what's trauma? I don't have a trauma.
So was that the first time you'd cried about it in that psychology lecture, would you say?
Yeah, so that was the first time. And then I did not stop crying for 3 months. When I say I woke up crying, went to sleep crying, and I just did not understand it, because the thing I kept saying in my head was, it happened 10 years ago. Why am I still crying? Because I never cried. I never felt it. So it was all coming at once. And because it was coming with so much intensity, plus all the baggage of the 10 years, I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't tell you whether I was angry or sad, because I was feeling it all at the same time. Even though I was like passionate about psychology, would be the first person who would tell you like mental health is so important, you shouldn't be ashamed about going to therapy. I was working in like 3 different charities at the time as a helpline volunteer, telling people on a daily basis how it's okay to go to therapy. And I had to leave my own keys at home to go to the first session because I knew I would quit and walk back home. Like, so I left my keys at home and then had to sit on the doorstep when I got back from therapy because I didn't have my keys. But that was the only way I took myself to therapy, because it's so much easier to preach it than do it yourself.
How can you help other people, just putting your life coach kind of hat on for a bit, just based on the context of what you've just said to us, how can you help other people to be more decisive in making the steps that you made? Because I think there's probably a lot of people who are probably listening who might resonate with some of the things you've said.
You don't have to wait until you're not scared. I was terrified in that first session. And then when I got told I had PTSD, I was like, traumas for rape victims and war veterans. I didn't have that. I didn't go through anything. How I would describe my 15 surgeries was, it wasn't a big deal. Like, that's how I used to say it. And that's what I said in my first session. It's not a big deal. I didn't go through something severe like a rape or war.
It was just surgery. You know, you put the
prefix. It was just dying when I was 11 years old. But yeah.
You think of it in that sense. It was just 15 surgeries. Yeah. And you're like, it was not just
that. But I'd spent a whole lifetime of diminishing it. So I'm not surprised I said that. And I'm not surprised. I genuinely believed it. And it took me maybe a year and a half to wrap my head around the word trauma, just because I was like, I wouldn't use it. And I was like, it's not me, it's too extreme. And but I was surrounded by people who diminished it as well, and not in a negative way, in a way that I got always told, you can do anything you like and you are the same as your brother, and my brother has no surgeries and is healthy and has always been healthy. And so I was always told, like, and so they didn't diminish it in a negative way. They were diminishing it in a way that, like, these won't define you. You can do whatever you like. But with every negative comes a positive. And I guess the negative that I took away from it was that, oh, okay, so they're not important. Push it down. And so that's the largest thing I would tell someone, is that if you're scared about not being you anymore, you're right. You, the version of you have right now is going to change. It's not a bad thing.
Do you know what I would love right now is for your 10-year-old self to just be able to see or hear you speak is the way you have on this podcast.
She would not believe it.
No, it's funny, isn't it? When you look back to, like you were saying about Glennon Doyle's sort of that 10-year-old girl, that pivotal moment where, you know, you take on the weight of society almost. And like, if she could see you right now and where you have come.
But the great thing is with inner child meditations, especially, like, I do get the opportunity to reparent my 10-year-old in the way that I needed it, which, as much as parents are doing their best job, they can't do it in the specific way you need it unless you can vocalize it. And I couldn't. So I do, in these meditations, go back and talk to that 10-year-old and say everything I needed to hear, which was like, you're allowed to be sad. You're allowed to be angry. Scream as much as you want. Like, no one's going to hear you. Just scream. And giving myself the 10-year-old in me to feel all of those things, you can still do it. Like, just because your childhood's over doesn't mean you can't process what was in it.
I whisper into my daughter's ear at night, I go, you can do anything, you can be anyone. And then the other night she's just like, can you just go away, I need to go to bed. Okay,
yeah, right.
But that's a wrap for today, and it's just been so great speaking to you. And I suppose we've talked about a lot, we've covered a lot, I've learned a lot from both of you. What would you say is your main sort of takeaway from everything we've spoken about?
Sitting with your body is the most important thing. I think it's the thing that's created the most change in my life. And figuring out where emotions sit in your body gives you the power to handle so much more. And what it's given me is realizing that I can survive anything.
The big thing I've taken from what you've said is why me versus why not me?
Yeah.
Is there another sort of point or phrase or something that you'd like to say to, I'm going to say it specifically to my daughter, to all the little 10-year-old girls out there?
I think the main thing I say is you're more than your beauty. Like, your beauty is so not important. And even if you're the definition of beauty now, we all eventually lose it. Therefore, you need to make your life more important than what you look like. So you're more than your beauty, and you always have been.
Got literally chills. So that's it for this week's podcast. It's been seriously emotional.
We've gone somewhere.
Yeah, it's been so lovely to have you on, Michelle. And thank you, Kimberly, for speaking sense, as always. If you want to know more, you can go to Arla Lacto Free's amazing social media. So you can get more information there. Any questions you have, anything you want to get involved in and the topics that we've discussed today, let us know. Share us, not us personally, because that would be a bit weird. Share the podcast anywhere with your friends, and we'll be back next time. So bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.